Hello and a cosy welcome to this episode of About the Adventure podcast. In this interview, you'll meet Martin Swithenbank, who tells us that working outside has been a revelation from what he did previously in formal education. He's now doing what he always wanted to do as an outdoor instructor and feels very much at home. It was lovely to invite him into my home, where he joined me for a couple of brews on a blustery winter day in the Peak District. He had travelled from Marsden and spent the night at a local hostel before enjoying the next blustery day in the hills. I found his story really inspiring, and I'm sure you will too.
I'm normally all right in the cold. Well, I used to be all right in the cold, but as I've got a bit older, actually, I'm suffering getting a bit colder in the cold. I do. I'm approaching half a century, and I kind of like, I actually feel like, wow, it's very different to being in my 20s, especially working outside now as well. It's really different, you know, just getting older. And not, I'm not old, but I'll be 50 next year, and it's really different to being 30 next year. But I'm never going to give up. I'd have to fall apart for that to happen. Physically fall apart. And it's not, I will before I stop climbing.
I have like fingers falling off.
Yeah, totally. Totally. I mean, I would have to not physically be able to tie onto a rope anymore to stop me climbing, because it's a lifeline.
So how long have you been working outdoors then?
I've been working outdoors for just under 5 years now.
What do you do out there?
I predominantly work with 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds, so year five school kids, generally mainstream schools. We do a range of activities, so we focus quite a lot on team build skills, but we climb, we occasionally go caving, we do a lot of water sports stuff as well. We climb on rock, we climb on a climbing wall, the place where I work, and yeah, you know, go walking in the river. We go into the woods. We play games in the woods. We spend a lot of time outside. Quite a bit of work with youth engagement as well, and with SEN groups and older SEN groups as well. Yeah, yeah, a range of stuff. I've just done quite a bit of work with West Yorkshire Police for their Aspire programme. So young people, teenagers who've been either in the care system and or in the youth offending system, and the programme sort of aims to catch them at some point to try and intervene. It's like an intervention programme, so that was good fun. And all that was all outdoor, didn't matter what the weather was doing, it was outside.
As you've experienced so far, is it as good as it sounds?
Working outside?
Yeah, and with young, like with these 10, 11-year-olds.
Yeah, working outside has been a revelation from what I did previously. I never worked with 10 and 11-year-olds. I always worked with adult learners, so 18+. Never thought I wanted to work with that age group, younger kids, until I had an experience during COVID, and that changed a little bit. And now that is, I wonder what I've been doing all of these years, because 10 and 11-year-olds are amazing fun, outside especially, and I love it. I love working with them. They're great. They ask such fantastic questions.
Like what? Can you think of any?
questions. I can't really think of anything in particular, sort of things that they ask, but it's more their observations. It's more how they see things. And they're just endlessly inquisitive as well. So they will ask questions about, you know, if you're in the woods, they will ask what this is, what's that? They'll be picking things up and bringing it to you and saying, what's this? What's that? Can I eat this? Can I smell it? What does it feel like? You know, so we occasionally just go and we look for things, we forage for things. But yeah, they're just inquisitive, and they're at a great age, you know, where they're not tiny, so they're not hugely dependent, but they've not kind of got into the teenage years, so they've not got that sort of difficulty as well. They're just at a great age where they are so much fun on the whole.
And what was that experience you had during COVID that changed everything?
Well, I worked in a secondary school, and I trained, actually, initially. I graduated in 99 with a fine art degree. So I'm from an arts background, and I spent years and years working in studios, in universities and colleges, managing studios, working with adult learners, making work, putting exhibitions up, etc. Anyway, I ended up working in a secondary school in the art department, which then during COVID closed, you know, the school closed down kind of thing. And I got sent to work with the at-risk kids and the kids whose parents were key workers. And that was in the junior school. So I was working with 6 to 10, 6 to 11. I was terrified initially of that. And
yeah, it's such a different age group, isn't it?
Massively different. Massively different to 16 plus, 18 plus, really. And we just had a blast. It was great fun. Yeah, I'd got into that situation thinking everybody else really disliking just being in the room with a group of kids and the kids were just doing their own thing on tablets or whatever, you know. And when I went into that situation, I was just, oh, it's dire, is this? It's really boring. It's really, oh, we just sit about and just look after these kids. And I went into it with a group of other people I was working with and thought, I'm not going to do it like that. No way. So we found some balls and we found some bats and we found some footballs and we just played out, basically. We just went outside. We drew pictures when it was raining. So we drew underwater scenes and scenes in the air, like magical scenes. And then we went out and played football or we went out and played tennis or went for a walk around the school grounds or something and just spent time sat on the grass having a chat. And they were brilliant fun.
And then how did you make that transition into what you're doing now?
I kind of went down a little bit of a road of wanting to work then, because I'd worked with kids with some sort of special educational needs, but kids who were better off with us than with their families, let's say, during COVID. And I thought, I'm kind of quite interested in that. I'd done a little bit of work with adult learning, sort of return to education stuff in colleges as well. I thought, I want to kind of pursue that a little bit. So I went into some of the most, I made it a kind of mission to go into some of those challenging schools in Kirklees that I could work in. And I went to work in behaviour departments with kids who had significant problems in their lives, you know, so teenagers, kids who were coming up to do GCSEs. I did that for a bit. I worked in two schools that were pretty hardcore, really. And, you know, I worked with a couple of guys, couple of lads, and the problems that they had in the four walls of the school that they were in were so significant, I ended up being on their side at the end of it. Because I could see the problems that they were having in school. And I remember saying in one school to the head of behaviour, I said, can I, because I've been a climber for a lot of years, and saying, can I just take this lad to a climbing wall? Or can I just take him out of the grounds? Can I do something? Because he's not going to do anything in here. He cannot learn in this environment. And the answer was no, you can't. So
that's frustrating.
Massively. And the answer was just, all I want you to do is manage his behaviour. We're not going to get any work out of him. He's not going to get any GCSEs. All I want you to do is stop him from abusing the rest of the staff or the students.
But that's kind of, it sounds like that's what you were trying to do. You're trying to get him out of that environment.
Yeah.
To have a new experience, because that would have helped his behaviour probably.
It would have. I think it would have massively have helped his behaviour. And now looking back, I'm almost certain it would have changed his behaviour.
Because you've seen it in other.
Because I've seen it transform people's young people's lives.
Yeah.
And you know the answer was no. Anyway, so I ended up. It was a bit heartbreaking, really, because I was getting somewhere with him, and then I think it was the second lockdown or the final lockdown happened. The school shut down. He went back home, and he was much better off at school than he was at home. He was with a very, very serious group of lads in Huddersfield. He came back after that lockdown, and his behaviour was completely different, a lot worse. And I just thought, I can't fight against this system from where I'm stood. I can't do it. And I really wanted to help this lad, and I couldn't help him. I was watching him just go very, very quickly downhill, and probably, you know, ending up in youth offending or ending up, you know, worse maybe. I've no idea. But that was a moment of just like, there's got to be a different way to do this. There's got to be something different. So a friend of mine got in touch with me and he said, do you know there's a job coming up at this outdoor centre? And I was about 44 maybe at the time, something like that. It's an apprenticeship in outdoor education. And I said, well, I'm in my 40s, mate. There's no way that they're going to take me on. You know, I'm old for that. They want a 16-year-old straight from school or something. And this guy works, he's worked all of his life in outdoor ed. And he's a senior instructor now at Leeds Met. And he said to me, just apply for it. Just do it. Just do it. See what happens. So, and I didn't apply for it until about 2 days before, and I remember talking to my partner and she said, why don't you just apply for it, Martin? She said, I'm a bit let down that you didn't do it, but I was terrified of applying for it because I just didn't, that change was massive. I knew I wanted to change it, but I just didn't know. It was too unknown. So I applied for it and I went for the interview and I talked to the guys at the interview and I remember thinking, this is what I should have been doing. It was like this revelation of like, why have I been doing that other stuff?
And it's so interesting that you were so, you felt so reluctant to apply for it.
Yeah.
Wow. Why do you think that was?
I think I felt like I belonged in formal education because that's all I'd known. That's all I'd done. I'd worked at the university, at Huddersfield University. I'd worked at a couple of colleges. I'd worked in mainstream secondary. And I thought, I remember saying as well to my partner at the time, I've kind of typecast myself. That's what I'm doing now. I work in education. That's what I do. I'd never even thought of outdoor education as being education. I just thought it was playing outside, which essentially it is. You can weave a lot of other things into there, you know.
Yeah, and obviously you had a lot of experience of working with young people, although a different age group is.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, you can transfer those skills, can't you? And I definitely felt like it wasn't for me to apply. I felt like I would almost kind of be an intruder into that world at 44. Having never been involved in that world of outdoor education.
That's incredible that you felt that age limitation, even if it wasn't actually true.
I think I taught myself into that position of typecasting myself and I convinced myself that that was that. There was no other pathway for me at all. But then I applied for it and, yeah, like I say, I went for the interview and it was like, it sounds really cheesy, it sounds really cliche, but it was like going home. I stood there and I just thought, well, this is great.
What did you see? What did you see that made you think that?
Kids come and stay with us. And it's I think it's grade two listed Victorian mansion. Our base is in the old coach house. There was something about how it smelled when I walked in and how it looked and just how it felt. There was an age to it and it was quite grimy because some of the kids going through it and it smelled of neoprene and it smelled of drying caving kit and everybody there looked like they spent their lives outside and they had all these lines across their faces and they were kind of like just permanently sort of red-faced, suntanned kind of thing. And they were all just kind of, they were all really down-to-earth people who loved being outside. And to them, it was, you know, it's a lifeline as well. If you know, I mean, my boss definitely, you know, he's like a caged animal. You know, he can't spend longer than 5 minutes inside. You know, and I'm the same. And it just felt like I'd gone home. Oh. It was an amazing experience just being there. I'd had this dream from being quite young of working in an outdoor centre. It was that or being a ranger up in the Lake District, being a National Trust ranger. But I'd watched a programme when I was about 11 or 12 and it was called Out on the Edge. And I told this story in my interview for this job. And it was about an outdoor centre in the Lake District, and it was about these outdoor instructors working with kids from sort of challenged backgrounds, and how the outdoors was transformative. Something about that stuck. I can remember the theme tune. I can remember what it felt like watching it. It always rained as well. But I can remember, things, as we sort of talked about earlier, I remember things in smell quite a lot, and in kind of like sensations. I don't have an amazing memory for things a lot of the time. I remember something about how it smelt, even though I was watching it on the television. And then I got to this place. I got to this outdoor centre, and I recognised it immediately. I'd never been there, but I just recognised it immediately. I knew it, you know. It was amazing, really.
They obviously responded well to it, because you got the job.
Yeah. I think what they really wanted, they didn't actually want somebody who was kind of 16 or 17 who was coming in to do an apprenticeship. They actually wanted an instructor, but the authority that runs the centre didn't want to pay for a full instructor. So they said, well, we'll go down the other avenue with that kind of thing. So I turned up with 20 years experience of teaching, was like, yeah, I'll do an apprenticeship in outdoors. Fantastic. Already a climber, had no qualifications for outdoor stuff at all. Never worked, well, only really worked a little bit with sort of the age group that we work with. Didn't even know whether I was going to get on with working with that age group in the outdoors. Never worked with anybody outside before, really. Yeah. And they said, oh, yeah, well, you know, very happy to give you a job. So I did the apprenticeship. And
was it on the spot they said you got the job, or was it a case of they had to interview other people? And
there were quite a few people there. We had an online interview, and then we had a physical, where we had to do a range of kind of physical tasks, you know, not like a boot camp kind of thing. We had to build things and whatever, which I just saw as great fun. You know, we had to build an egg throwing machine.
Egg throwing?
out of bamboo canes and elastic bands. And I think everybody else was a bit like, oh, what are we going to do?
Yeah, that's what I'd be like. Yeah. No, don't make me do anything.
And I just thought, oh, this is great. Let's see if we can crack this egg. Let's see if we can smash it. Because I don't know, I just sort of tend to not take things too seriously.
What a great interview.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And then we did a couple of other things, and I wasn't nervous about it.
Like you said, you felt at home.
It just felt like I was at home, and like I'd known these guys for years, you know, and it was easy.
And then what was the training like? Were you doing the training while you were on the job, or did you have to do some intensive stuff?
I ended up doing the apprenticeship, pretty much doing the job at the same time, really. I spent a bit of time shadowing people who'd done it for a lot of years, and I was doing two qualifications at the same time. So I was doing a paddle sport qualification and a climbing wall qualification alongside the apprenticeship, and were pretty much, well, being there full time as well, 39 hours. Which goes against the grain for me a lot of the time. Anyway, it's the second only time in my life I've worked full time. So it was full on, you know, and I was absolutely wrecked by the weekend. But I just had that belief that it would change things. So you do it to change things, don't you?
What has it changed? Because obviously you're a few years down the line now. So what has changed for you?
I think I'm a lot more confident than I ever was in my ability to make decisions that might impact other people, that will affect other people. And just a lot more confident in myself, in who I am, in my ability to work with people as well, and to try and relate to people. And not, I think one of the biggest changes is not being scared about going into new situations, actually seeing those as a growth, you know, and going from not wanting to, you know, not seeking new situations and new challenges to actually now seeking those things out, looking for those opportunities to grow. And I never was like that, ever. I never would have done that, you know.
Wow. What sort of things then, outside of your job, what sort of things would you maybe seek out in terms of challenges or opportunities?
Well, I mean, one of them is coming down here to talk to you.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because I saw this as a great opportunity to meet somebody and to come and have a chat mm-hmm. about things that are transformative in people's lives, and that's a great thing to do, you know, and then to maybe give that message to other people. If one person listens to it and it changes their life, then that's the job done, isn't it? That's great. You
absolutely
know.
Change can be really hard sometimes to put yourself into if you're consciously choosing change. Like, change can be hard if it happens to you, for example, like a redundancy or a breakup or whatever it is, a type of grief. But then also to then approach change from a place of choice and saying, I'm going to change my place of work or my behaviour, whatever it is. That's hard in another way, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. And going back to that, really, that formative point for me, it was that I wanted things to change because I thought my input in the education system for young people had to change. But it was this point of, like, not panic, but it was this point of, like, I can't do this anymore. I can't continue doing this because I don't believe in it. It's not that I don't believe in mainstream education. It works for some people, but it really doesn't work for some people.
Yeah, it sounds like you did try to make some suggestions about how you might help a particular student, or maybe there are a few students. And when you're being told no, then that's when it starts to become frustrating and maybe against, like, your personal values or morals.
That was the thing that it started to jar against me, because what I could see was this, especially this one lad that I worked with, I could see him suffering because of that. And if I can see somebody suffering and I can't help them when I know I can help them, if I'm not allowed to help them, I struggle with that. And that's something that I've realised in working in the outdoors now is, you know, working with people who are from the care system, or working with young people who are from, you know, youth offending. I've worked a lot with people with, you know, fairly profound mobility issues, or, you know, worked to sort of climb with kids with Downs and done a lot of firelighting sessions, you know, all that sort of stuff. And it's almost a need now in me is that I need to, if I can, to make a positive change in people's lives. And some of the moments I've had with some of these guys have been just remarkable. Like, just bring me out, you know, just make me cry when I think about what amazing people I have worked with who have had such profound difficulties in their lives, you know. And you're there at that point. And you're there. And you're the person who is not helping them, because they're very capable of doing it themselves, but you're there to facilitate that space. You're giving them the space to do it. You're giving them the tools to do it. You let them do it. That's amazing. That's a massive thing.
And what changes do you see in them on sort of when they come out on the other side of what you facilitate?
Well, it's great, isn't it? Because it's a dual thing. So you learn and they learn. So every single person I work with, every single group I work with, I never put myself in the position of boss or position of in charge. So I learn from them as much as they learn from me. And that's what I try and do with every group of people. And by doing that, they can teach me things. I've been told all sorts of stuff that I didn't know were, you know, things you can eat in the woods. No idea. I thought I knew a lot of things you could eat in the woods, but I've got 10-year-olds telling me you can eat this and you can eat that and it's fine.
Do you trust them?
Not always. But yeah, you know, you see people change. You see people go from, either a state that nobody understands them, that they're set against the world, the world's set against them, or that they can't do anything because they've been told that they can't do anything. They've been told that they're not capable. or they do have quite profound sort of problems in their lives, and society dictates that they can't do this thing, and actually they come out of the other end and they have done that thing. They've done, you haven't done it for them. You've just said, you can do that. You can, you are very capable of doing that, and they do it.
Do you find that they resist at first, generally speaking, or do they just feel that same feeling that you got when you walked in that building and felt that sense of home?
I think it depends who I'm working with or who one is working with, but some people can be resistant, and I think that resistance comes from being told that they're not capable, that they can't do this. But I absolutely firmly believe that the first minute of meeting a group of people, that's the crucial point. And if you can communicate to that person, I think you've got to be able to read that group. My manager always says this, within the first 30 seconds, first minute, you've got to know what that group of people needs from you. Do you need to be in there, or do you need to step back? What challenges are these people facing? You need to understand that. Because you've got this chance. You've got this amazing chance to try and change somebody's life. Sounds grand, doesn't it? But you've got this amazing chance to change somebody's life. Don't mess that chance up. Think about it. Some groups, you just go in and you like storm into it and they love it. Some groups are not like that, you know, and you've got to gauge that appropriately. And if you gauge it well enough, you allow those people to understand that actually they are safe and you're not going into that transaction trying to judge them. You're going into that group or just that one-to-one as an equal, and you're just going to do this thing together and you're going to explore it together. And I think that changes people's initial reaction to you if you go in kind of wondering about, like, you know, you're amazing or whatever. It's, nobody really ever responds to that very well.
Do you feel like you have more freedom now to work, to be yourself, to bring yourself into these facilitated activities?
Yeah. Well, I'm me now, and I never was before. I never stop being who I am now. And it works for me. Because there's that congruence there, you know. Again, that kind of Carl, you know, we were talking about Carl Rogers earlier on, that Carl Rogers idea of congruence. To be congruent, the way that you speak has got to be the way that you feel and think. And I think people pick up on, if there's an incongruence in, I think people pick up on that. Mm. If you're not being honest about who you are, you know, if you're in a situation of maybe therapy with somebody as well, that therapist has got to be honest with you and not see you as the person who's undergoing therapy and that they're this other person. They've got to be a person as well.
Yeah, they need to show their vulnerability.
That's exactly it. You've just got to be you. You can't, because you can't be anybody else.
Which is easier said than done, especially if you
hugely
are working in, I mean, you're still working for an institution.
Yeah,
obviously,
yeah,
it's a very different institution compared to where you were before.
Yeah, it is, and we don't really have any responsibility to stick to curriculum, anything like that at all, you know, even though we work with the age group that we work with. We play outside. And that's what we do on a day-to-day basis, but that can massively change people, can't it?
How do you get that balance between play and curiosity and then respect?
Anybody I work with, I believe in allowing them to set their own boundaries. If you think the group might be a bit of a spicy group, possibly, you might have a chat with them first and just say, look, you know, this is the behaviour that we expect, and does everybody agree that that's reasonable? And anybody not respecting that for the rest of the group or for themselves is going to be asked to step out. And get everybody to agree with that. And then actually it becomes a self-monitoring thing. You know, I've worked with these groups from West Yorkshire Police, and we've had that conversation at the start. Somebody stepped out of line. Another member of the group said, hang on a minute, we weren't supposed to be using that word, or we weren't supposed to be doing that, or whatever. Don't ruin it for everybody else. Come back in again. And all you're doing is just monitoring that and managing that a little bit, you know. And not being scared if somebody does cause problems, not being scared to just follow that up and say, look, you know, we had this agreement. You're going to have to set this one out. Following through with that. You know, the setting boundaries thing is important. It's an important step, very early step. Set those boundaries. Everybody knows where they stand. But to treat people with respect. That's the thing. Treat people with respect and like they are a human, because they are a human, you know.
Yeah, and that's, you know, regardless of where you work, really, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if you're not doing that, especially in education, you need to have a serious think about what you're doing and why you're doing it. If you're not treating people with respect and as a human, you know, definitely some people don't do that.
Yeah, and I think sometimes that's when it's hard, if you're in a work environment where you are doing your best to respect others, and then if you're not receiving it back, that's when I think it can become a massive issue. Do you feel, I'm going to assume that you do, because you're talking so positively about your work environment, but do you feel like your colleagues, do you feel like you receive respect from your colleagues that you...
Yeah, I do. It's not easy. It's quite... This is one of the things that's been quite difficult, is when I went into it, I definitely had this feeling of being an imposter, because I was a bit older. I started a new chapter and I got into it, and you know, working with people who've been doing it for 20 years, 25 years, something like that. And I had a really serious imposter syndrome thing going on, where I just didn't feel like I belonged. And my confidence was massively low. I didn't believe in my own ability to begin with, until my boss, my manager, said to me during one assessment, we were doing a paddle sport assessment, and I was really unsure. I was supposed to be leading this session. I was never into any paddle sports before I started working there. So it was brand new. I'd been in a canoe twice, I think, you know. I had no idea, and I fell out of it as well on a river, and I was freezing cold. So that was my experience of canoeing. And suddenly I was in this position where I would be leading groups in canoe.
That's scary.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it absolutely is. And we'd gone into this assessment. He's an old school paddler. He's got a lot of coaching, paddle coach stuff, and he's been doing it for years and years and years. I was really nervous, and I was fumbling through it a little bit, and I was saying things like, well, I'm just going to demonstrate this ferry glide, because I want you all to do this ferry glide after I was trying to run this session. I'm not really sure whether I can do it or not, but I'll give it a try. And afterwards, he said to me, this lack of self-confidence, Martin, he said, it was really blunt, and he said, you need to just drop it. He said, because you don't need that. I don't need that. And your participants definitely don't need that. He said, you need to be confident in what you're doing and believe in what you're doing, because you are capable of doing it. And I was initially, yeah.
That's my big talk, isn't it?
Yeah, it totally was. And initially I was really annoyed by it. You know, I was like, really, like, about the directness of it, I think. And it was only afterwards that I thought, but he's right. He's totally right.
Yeah, because if you're showing an element of doubt when you're guiding, leading, teaching something,
yeah,
then they are gonna doubt you.
Yeah, I mean, it's like going running up on kinder, isn't it, with somebody who's never run on kinder before, and you say, I think the track's over there, it's a bit misty, but I'm not quite sure. Yeah. You know,
they're literally gonna be like, oh, I better get my map out then.
Yeah, exactly. So and then when that happened, It was difficult at first, because I was working with, it's predominantly male where I work, and I think a lot of the outdoor sector it came from kind of military stuff, didn't it, really? So it was predominantly male and very competitive. So, you know, one of the guys who I used to work with was a competitive fell racer. He'd done Bob Graham rounds, serious runner, really lovely guy, but the serious, you know. And my boss is a caver, and he's a sea kayaker, and another guy's a really big road cyclist. And I just was coming into it as like this geezer who'd come from an art and design background. and didn't have the confidence. And it wasn't that they were being kind of arrogant with him, you know, none of that. It was because I didn't have the confidence. And, you know, the I don't like the term, but it's true, fake it till you make it. You know, I really don't like it, but the core of that's quite true. You're working with people in what potentially can be a dangerous situation. If you're not confident, then they're not going to be confident. You know, you need to be the person who's the strong part. Even if you're silent, you're quiet with that, you know, you need to be confident. Otherwise, the people that you're trying to lead, I haven't got a chance of changing if they're terrified. And their experience then, their experience of being outside with you is, oh man, that was terrifying. I thought we were all going to die. You know, I'm never going outside again, kind of thing. And they never do. They go back to doing what they do in the house.
Yeah, because they've had such a... Yeah. Because
their experience has been traumatic.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was difficult at first trying to kind of see, understand where I was.
How do you actually drop that act, I suppose?
What, the lack of confidence?
Yeah. How do you actually... Because it's one thing someone telling you, don't be like that.
Yeah.
But actually putting it into action.
The guy who employed me has given me a lot of chances. And he's trying to run a service. So what he needs to do in his job is to run a service. He's not going to run that service with people who he thinks can't do the job. So when he said that, but he basically wrote a job for me and told me to apply for it. He said, I don't think anybody else is going to apply for it. So it's going to be out for a day, basically. Apply for it, you'll probably get it. So he wrote me a job. So this, there was something there about his belief in me and wanting me to do the job. And I think then when he said that to me, I thought, he does believe in my ability to do it. I've got to believe in my ability to do it as well. There's a reason why I'm here. I'm not here just because I've worked in education for 20 years, though that helps. I'm not here because I've been a climber for 25 years. I'm here because this guy has watched me work with groups and thought, he's good at this, he can do this, and I want him to work on this team. I think I went from this position of being very, very unsure of myself to kind of almost the other side of thinking and feeling like I was being really arrogant with it, but actually I was just being really honest about it and saying, this is what I'm good at. This is what I should have been doing all along. And I am really good at doing this. This is the thing. And owning that and knowing that, you know, and not apologizing for being good at it. But that change, it's really hard to believe in yourself, isn't it? It's really difficult to go from feeling like you shouldn't be there to suddenly thinking, I am brilliant at this.
It's not always just a case of getting a qualification, because sometimes you can get a qualification and then when you go and perform as such, you still have all those hurdles. Even if you've practiced it, even if you've, you know, led before, actually going at it in a confident way, it's really, really different to say basically I belong here and own your position.
That's been quite a journey, to be honest with you, from somebody with very low confidence. And like I say, going into that position and thinking, I shouldn't, why am I here? I shouldn't be here. You know, I've not been doing this for 20 years of my life. Like, I don't know what happens. I don't know any of this. And then suddenly thinking, it's the same thing. And it's the same thing as it's reaching that impasse in your life, isn't it? Where you can follow one path or you can follow the other path. And you've got to weigh up the consequences of, I can continue not believing in myself. I can continue without any of this confidence. But where's that going to lead me? Where am I going to be at the end of that? Or I can take this thing that this person said to me and I can use that. And I still think about that he said to me. I still think, you don't need that. Like, I know that the participants don't need it. And I know that he doesn't need it because he wants me to just go in and do a job. And that's all right. I understand that. But I don't need that either. And that was the real activating bit. And it rings in my head now. It's like, you don't need that doubt. You need that positivity. And you need that belief, you know. Otherwise, what are you going to do?
And do you think that the key to that is... Do you think it was, for example, him saying that to you in an assertive way? Do you think it's a kind of, I think of it as maybe like a sort of type of mentorship or...
Yeah.
The reason I'm pulling that out is because that's what's happened with me as well. It's, it's been other people in my coaching world, my my leadership world, who have said to me, why are you doubting yourself when I can see that... You know, this is like a gift, or I'm responding well to this thing that you're delivering. But they can see both. They can see the gift and they can see the self-doubt. And it's confusing to them, I think, isn't it?
Yeah.
I suppose you can think about it in terms of like if you're on the receiving end of that. And because sometimes, you know, you might see someone and you think, God, they're really good at that. But they're really doubting themselves. And you sort of think, why, when they're so good at it? So I suppose you can be on the other end of it, can't you? But...
Yeah, and I think that throughout most of my life has been a real problem for me. You know, the lack of self-confidence has been a huge problem. But yeah, that shocking me out of it almost, of like just being so direct with me, worked. And yeah, you know, it's sort of looking back at periods of my life and thinking, you know, why was I like that? Why did that happen? And it's all about confidence. It's all about the belief in yourself to be able to do things. And I think to get things wrong as well, to a position now where actually you seek failure because it's you know, I climb now, and I climb, I almost seek fail point. Well, I do seek fail point almost every time I climb because it's a position of strength. I seek the point where I can no longer hold on because I'm so pumped. You know, as a friend of mine would say, all it is weakness leaving the body. And like, you seek failure because it allows you to grow. You're never going to grow if you stay in that comfortable point. You've got to push that boundary, push that envelope. You've got to keep pushing, and you will keep developing and keep growing. But that's really hard to do when you don't believe in yourself, because you see failure as a failure. And it's not.
Yeah, and then it reconfirms. It can reconfirm your belief about yourself. And
Rather than
as a way to grow. And
Yeah, exactly. It reaffirms that idea that you are a failure. Mm. And learning that, I think that's probably been one of the most important things I've learned in my life, is how to manage that self-belief, how to manage that idea that just because you fail, it doesn't reaffirm the idea that you're a failure. Just means that you're seeking something a little bit different. You're just looking for something different, you know. And to believe in yourself a lot more, because you're capable, you know. I mean, that's what, you're a coach, you know. That's maybe what you do a lot of the time, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And so many people, you know, they come to me and straight away, one of the first things they do, like generally speaking, is that they squash their dreams in the very beginning.
Really?
And that is what I want to hear about.
Right.
You know, they go, oh, well, maybe I've always wanted to be a writer, but I can't do that, can I? You know, it's like they talk themselves out of it. Right. And they're not even writing. And I can totally relate to that, you know, whether it's drawing or writing or public speaking or, you know, whatever it is. It's like people tell you, they brush over it and they say, right, let's get down some real talk. And I'm like, hang on a minute.
That was the real talk.
Tell me a bit more about that dream. And I'm not saying that you can or you should always turn your dream into your job or your career. And I'm not saying that can happen overnight and, you know, all those things. But I do think that it's important to talk about and also to at least explore. Yeah. You know, so if you're not a writer, then you're never going to be one if you're not writing.
No.
And maybe through writing, you'll figure out what sort of writer you are or if you want to make it into your career, your profession, or whether actually it's going to be something that you do in your spare time, like climbing, for example. You know, it might not be, and okay, it maybe is part of your outdoor education as well, but it's just about getting to know people and who they are and the bits that they're squashing and drowning out because that thing isn't possible for them. It couldn't possibly be possible for them because it's too late or because they're not even doing it. They haven't done it since they were a kid. And that is where I encourage people to go to get to know themselves. And it's hard for them because they're telling themselves that it's vulnerable. It's vulnerable for them to even consider writing. Even just for 30 minutes, you know, that could send them crying. It could send them,
really?
Yeah, because it's such an emotional experience. Yeah. But I think that's really a really important part of where they're heading.
Well, you see, you do the same thing that I've described. So I describe when I meet a group, you should be able to read that group within a minute. You do exactly the same thing as a coach, don't you? You meet that person, and within the first minute, you've already identified where they need to return to. And that's a massive skill, isn't it? That, I don't think that's something that you can learn. I think that's a response in yourself.
Well, it's because it's what I'm interested in. I want to really know the person. Some people say, oh, I'll give you my CV history. And it's like,
right.
You know, that it can be interesting, but I'm much more interested in who they are and who they spend time with and their dreams. And, you know, like, I want to know, I actually genuinely want to know, not because I'm a coach, but just from a human level, I really want to know that person and what they're about and the bits that they're putting aside because of reality, because of life. And it's like, no, that's the best bit.
It absolutely is. Because if you let life do that, it does. It pushes it all aside and it steamrolls over it.
It can take over. And I'm not saying it's not part of life. It's not like I'm saying, oh, just forget all the responsibilities in your life. I'm saying, you know, they've got to be part of it. And I say to people, let's just, for the purpose of this session, let's talk about that thing that and I think it can be really hard for people. And obviously I have to gauge, a bit like you were saying about gauging, you have to gauge the tone, how much you push people to do that. They might not be ready, you know, so you have to gauge all those things so that it doesn't become all about what I want from the session. It's about where they're at as well.
There's a couple of points that are really interesting there. One is that, you know, pushing people. If you're going to push people, you know, your support needs to be equal. So otherwise people just end up panicking, don't they? But
because you don't want to send people too far too soon into something that they're not ready for. Because that change, it might not be about something creative. It might be about something in their life circumstances. And they might not be ready to consider that changing yet.
Yeah.
But even just by planting the question and then them maybe saying, oh, I'm not ready for that, they might go and look at it later in their own time.
I think that planting the question thing's an interesting point in it as well. Because all of those questions are already in there. It's just you do that job of filtering out what's the best question to ask at the best time. And even though it might not do anything immediately, it will be in there. And when the tape plays round again, suddenly that question's there again. It might be the right time to answer that question at that point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, pushing people and you've got to support them, haven't you? You know.
Yeah, and especially if they, because a lot of people are supporting others. If they've got children or they've got a partner and all those things,
definitely.
They might be so busy in their heads worrying about what other people think and how they're going to respond to change and and all their responsibilities to those people. It's almost like saying, I suppose when people come to a coaching session, it's saying, you exist as well. You know, what? Tell me about you. And that isn't easy for some people.
No, it's not, because some people, when life steamrolls over everything, they lose themselves, don't they? And at the end of the day, if all of that stuff that you're involved in disappeared, you're still a person, you're still you, and you need to have those things. You need to hold those things. I always think, you know, you can be in a relationship with somebody, but you're still a person. You are still, if that person wasn't there, as happens to a lot of people, you've got to maintain that independence. You've got to maintain those dreams. You've got to maintain what it is you want to do in your life, you know, and not just become part of that union with somebody else, you know. Yeah, and you mentioned expectations. I think that's really interesting as well, because I think that plays into it quite a bit. Definitely with what I do, some people, you know, I've worked with who go into that situation expecting that it's this session and we always do this and this is what I'm expecting. It's not about what you're expecting.
Yeah, yeah. Because where's the room for curiosity and play if you've like planned it all out in your head already? Like
you've already killed it.
Yeah,
you know, and like, and that feeds back into then if you go in with that idea of what you expect and the people you're working with, and not at that level, you know, you might plan to go and walk up Kinder Scout with somebody. You might get to the end of the road and that's enough, and you feel like you might feel like you've failed in your job because you haven't been up Kinder Scout. Well, but you haven't failed in your job. You've only failed in setting that goal initially. You shouldn't do that. It's because it's not about what you need. But that's hard, isn't it? You've got to know what people need and what people want, what people's limitations are.
Yeah, and sometimes you have to peel away the layers as well to actually get to that.
Because, the old onion analogy, you know. Yeah. Peel the layers back. See what each one is.
Yeah.
You know, get to
and
the
it's
core.
Fascinating.
Yeah, it is. It is fascinating.
So I always ask my guests to ask a question to people who listen to this podcast. Okay. So if you can imagine that you're sat with somebody who is thinking about a change in direction, what powerful question might you ask that person if they're thinking but scared?
I think the thing that was apparent to me at that point was, what happens if I don't take that chance? What are the consequences of me staying safe, basically? If I just maintain that position of like, yeah, but I know this, and I know that I've typecast myself into this position, but it's comfortable, and I don't take that risk, what happens then? Do I just continue doing that thing when I know that I need to change, you know? What are the consequences of not taking that risk? You've got to please your teenage self. You've got to please your current self and your deathbed self. And you've got to think about that in those choices, haven't you? You know, what would teenage self think? Self would think, oh my God, wow. You know.
Yeah, that's a really good question, actually, about teenage self. I would have wanted what I'm doing now, not sat at a desk in an office. That was not what I was imagining for myself.
You've got to take those risks, otherwise. Well, you know, you don't have to take those risks. You've always got a choice, but you've got, for me, you've got to think about the consequences of not taking that chance and believe in yourself that, you know, you can do it. You can affect that change, but only you can do that. Mm-hmm. That was such a massive thing, realising that. You are the architect. You design your own future, you know. Nobody else does.
I'm just thinking, what a conversation we've had after just like meeting a couple of hours ago.
But that's the beauty of it, though. Is it not? You know, I mean, I'd never met you. You'd never met me. And I just thought, yeah. And I just thought, what a great opportunity. Go down and meet this person. Have a chat.
And it all started with a conversation with your partner on Substack while I was in Italy.
I was at Substack?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I was in Italy, it was. And yeah, I just remember thinking, oh, I want to have this interview. Like, because your partner responded to a post I put out about a lad who I'd met on Kinder Scout. And he said he really wanted to get into... Yeah.
She said, yeah.
The outdoor work. He's 18 and he's like, he wants to work outdoors and he wasn't sure like how to get into it. And then I shared that, how I met him on the hill. Mm. And then, your partner responded and said about your work.
Yeah.
And that's why we're here now.
And that's why we're sat in your living room in Edale having a chat about changing your life.
Yeah, isn't it? It's brilliant.
And it should happen more.
Yeah.
People should...
These conversations so much.
It's just great, isn't it? Because it's amazing finding out about people's lives, isn't it, as well?
Yeah.
I'd read something in The Guardian recently about somebody... I can't remember where she was now, but she'd done a whole kind of series of interviews with people sat in a park. And she was sat on a bench and she would just... people who she saw, she would ask them if they wanted to have a chat. She'd never met these people ever, and she would just sit down and do exactly what you're doing and record, and just the average person walking past, some of the things that they'd done in their lives and experience that they'd had and struggles that they'd been through were massive.
I love that. There's a guy on Instagram who invites people to have a cup of tea. He's got like a flask of tea and he makes them a cup of tea and sits down and just asks them a couple of questions. Oh, 9 times out of 10, it sets me off crying.
It's just
incredible. Yeah,
it is amazing, isn't it?
Thinking all these people that you walk past, and
I believe in that humanity as well. No doubt, like you do, that we are just all people, and people just want to have a chat with each other and get on and not be in conflict. You know,
people want connection, don't they?
They do want connection. Yeah. I was talking about this with some friends of mine yesterday as well. About the social media thing, that, you know, it does connect people, but a lot of the time it drives people apart as well. And, you know, I do feel like kind of that's being slowly lost, is that ability to just stop somebody and say, hi.
Yeah. And that's the beauty of living somewhere like Edale or Marsden. You know, you do have that, that environment is a bit warmer and more friendly to saying hi.
Yeah.
And then I remember when I first came here, I was a bit shocked by it. I was kind of like, I exist here, you know, after living in London.
Okay.
So it's like you feel very different. It's like you start to, you feel like you really exist in a place, whereas in London you feel it more or less invisible. Right. And that adjustment is, and then I think when you then go into a city, I feel a difference then. And I'm not saying I want to be seen all the time, because, you know, like anyone, you want to hide sometimes.
Yeah, you do, absolutely. Yeah.
But,
definitely.
Yeah, it's just a very different mindset walking around a city to walking around a little village.
I mean, I came through Manchester Piccadilly on the way and from Marsden, which I don't think, you know, I mean, it was really bad weather in Marsden as it is. It was very dark when I set off. And, there was very few people about, you know, to suddenly being in but everybody says hello. And in Manchester Piccadilly, I was almost find myself walking through Piccadilly saying hello to people.
Yeah.
Like, they would just think you're crazy.
Yeah, it's like I was walking through Sheffield the other day and I was in a sort of walking past a through a cemetery, and there was just a couple of people about, and you sort of look up and you smile and you sort of gauge them with, and then you're like, oh yeah, I mean, Sheffield's a very friendly city, to be fair.
Yeah.
I don't think you get any too many funny looks if you said hello, but yeah, then you sort of remind yourself where you are.
Yeah.
You're so used to saying hi to everyone.
Yeah, and it's really different, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know,
Well, thank you for...
Absolute pleasure. It's great to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you so really much good to for talk to you. Telling us your story.
Well, I hope it was interesting. So.
Yeah. Massive thanks to Martin for sharing his story with us. Head over to abouttheadventure.com for more career change stories, to find out more about my outdoor coaching sessions, or to let us know what you think of this episode. We'd love to hear from you. Until next time.